Language changes. We've always known that, even if we didn't always like it. Long story short, new phrases and terms enter the language, like saying long story short to take the place of a longer phrase. That kind of condensing of language is a major feature of the way we write to each other online and in texts. I mean, why say, "You make me laugh," when three clicks get you to LOL? These are the changes Gretchen McCulloch explores in a book called Because Internet, Understanding the New Rules of Language. Gretchen is a somewhat rare breed, we think, an internet linguist studying the language of the internet. Her blog is All Things Linguistic. She co-hosts a podcast called Lingthusiasm, and she writes the resident linguist column for Wired. Gretchen lives in Montreal and joins us from there. Gretchen McCulloch, welcome to The Exchange.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Very good to have you. So you did get your master's in linguistics, then turned to the internet, or were they always paired together?
Well, I'd like to say that as a linguist, I have a hard time turning that language analyzing part of my brain off. You know, any time I'm encountering language, whether that's having a conversation and analyzing someone's vowels, or whether that's hanging out online, as, you know, I do, like many of us, I always want to find out, you know, what's going on? What are the patterns here that we can find out behind the mundane things that we're saying every day?
And there's a real, oh yeah, moment in the first page where you point out, you know, we always speak differently from the way we write. I mean, formal writing and the way we speak to each other is a very different kind of use of language.
Exactly. You know, you're a radio host. Do you go home and talk to your dog like this?
Who's a good boy?
Who's a good listener?
So this would seem to represent a big opportunity for us to break down some language barriers, to find some melding of these realms. Is this what's in the offing?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that, you know, we have this formal and informal domain in speech, and so expanding our notion of what's possible in writing to we can have formal and informal things there as well, and that's very exciting to me.
For a linguist, is internet writing a goldmine?
It is, absolutely. And one of the things that's really interesting is that linguists are really excited by informal language, unselfconscious language that gets at the kind of grammatical intuitions that we have as native speakers. And there's so much of that on the internet. There's so many things you can look at people's tweets if they've tagged them by their geolocation and say, you know, how do people in this area talk compared to that area? And you can do that, you know, without leaving the comfort of your own computer.
Interesting. So you're finding regionalisms even in the way that, I mean, it is really, I mean, is it spoken language in the fingers? Is that what we're talking about here, essentially?
Well, I like to think about it as informal writing, you know? So the spoken part is, you know, it's conversational, like an informal conversation, but there is a formal variety of speech as well. So it's not, strictly speaking, spoken as much as it is informal and written at the same time. And you do absolutely see things like, you know, if you look at geotagged tweets, you can see y'all versus you guys versus yins or something in Philadelphia show up in these particular areas, and, you know, people talk differently even when they're all on the same online medium.
Yins is Pittsburgh. I've been corrected on that
Pittsburgh,
one myself.
Okay, yeah. I should know this.
I'm impressed by the discussion of it being unself-conscious, the fact that people will fling some stuff out there, and it'll be like spoken language in the sense that it's just them without a lot of filter, really.
Yeah, or perhaps more accurately, conscious of your interlocutor, conscious of the person at the other end that you're trying to reach, but not filtered through an editor that tries to standardize it and end up with this sort of very narrow range of formal writing, the way that happens if you write a book. You know, I just wrote a book, and I don't talk like that when I'm talking to my friends on Twitter, you know?
Right.
So I use lots of periods in the book. I don't use that many periods in my text messages.
Okay. I want to ask you about the period stuff later on. It turns out to be a bigger deal than I thought it was. But I want to talk first about key smash, because you bring that up very early in the book. First of all, what is it?
So key smash is, you've probably seen it, it's this, you know, AFD thing where you type in, you know, you're so excited or so angry or so overwhelmed with emotion that you just kind of mash your fingers, it seems randomly, against the keyboard. And yet what I actually noticed is that there are patterns in key smash. And especially if you're doing it from a conventional full-sized keyboard, it often begins with ASDF, you know, that home row of keys, because that's where your fingers are. And so I did a survey of people saying, do you ever retype or adjust your key smash if you type randomly on the keyboard and it doesn't look like everyone else's? And most people said they did. And so it seems like even at this moment when we're, you know, being a million monkeys typing on a million typewriters, we're actually social monkeys. We're trying to do things that are in relationship to each other, and we're performing our key smash, even these inarticulate smashings, have patterns to them.
So even if you're basically screaming in anguish on your keyboard, you want to make sure you're screaming in anguish the correct way.
Well, you want to make sure you're screaming in anguish like everyone else is.
Ah, okay.
You know? These are the kind of norms that emerge from collective social practice. It's not someone, you know, came down from on high and said, thou shalt key smash this way. It's that you look at everyone else and you want to make your social intentions legible to them. I heard from some people who switched to the Dvorak keyboard, which has a different layout than the QWERTY keyboard you're probably used to, and a lot of them said they just stopped key smashing at all because with the different layout of keys, suddenly their key smashes didn't look understandable to other people.
So it's interesting. I think what I'm hearing is that there are all new ways of expression being invented all the time that may start as individual but ultimately end up getting to this land of community reinforcement.
Yeah, you know, language exists inside the head of the individual, but it also exists as a collective societal property where we use words because other people understand them.
All right, so let's pause here for some hand-holding because I think some members of our audience may need this. Is informal writing, like internet writing and texting, changing the formal stuff?
It's an interesting question. One place I like to look at this is if you think about the exclamation mark. Very much a part of formal standard English, you may have been taught how to use an exclamation mark. No one says an exclamation mark is new or, it's not based on the internet or anything like that. And yet, if you write an academic paper, even if you write a newspaper article or an op-ed or a novel or something like this, you're not going to see a lot of exclamation marks in formal prose. And that's because the exclamation mark indicates some sort of attitude on behalf of the author. I'm excited about this, or I want to call attention to this. And that's something that's still not so much part of formal prose, because the convention for formal prose is that it's static and it's disembodied, and it doesn't reflect the feelings of the person that's writing it. So if you can't even get an exclamation mark in an academic paper, I don't think we're going to see any emoji there anytime soon.
Probably not. Okay, much more to talk about emojis, exclamation points, and many more things with Gretchen McCulloch, the linguist from Montreal. Her book is called Because Internet, Understanding the New Rules of Language. Now our informal writing to each other via tweets and social media and other sorts of communications have changed the way we talk to each other. Join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Gretchen, are we lumping texting in with online language like tweets and social media?
I do lump texting in, especially because so many phones are, internet-enabled these days. But one thing that's interesting is that people do message slightly differently when it's a private message than when it's a public message. And, of course, it's a little bit hard to study this, particularly formally, because it's hard to get access to people's texts. But one way that people have looked at this is there's a great study on how people tweet using hashtags versus when they're at mentioning another person directly. And they find that people are more formal in their tweets with a hashtag, which is directed at a broader audience who might click on that hashtag and read a bunch of tweets from that. Whereas when they're addressing a particular person, even though they're both public, people tend to be more informal. They use more emoji, more emoticons, more creative respellings, more swear words, all of these things that are informal.
So always keeping the receiver in mind. It isn't just never out of the conversation, out of the consideration, I mean.
Exactly. It's very subtle. People are very good at paying attention to the social context they're communicating in.
You take us on a fun tour in the book of how we shorten language, and somehow you make us understand that one short block of consonants with two hyphens is pronounced mmm, and and even give the story on when the word acronym first appeared, 1940. Acronyms are really a lot of internet writing, aren't they?
Yeah, and acronyms are very efficient in terms of writing because you can take something like I don't know and transfer that into IDK, which is a lot faster to write. Whereas I don't know, or dunno, or as you just said, which was an interesting challenge to represent in writing.
You did it.
is much more efficient in speech. You can even do it if your mouth is full of food, but really hard to convey when you're writing it. So we have different types of communicative challenges and efficiency constraints in different mediums.
Does anybody try to actively enforce things like making sure that IDK is understood as I don't know, or is it just sort of a crowdsourced thing where as people start doing things like other people, it just sort of reinforces itself on that level?
Yeah, I like to think of it as an emerging sort of order. You know, if you think about the comparison between a formal garden, which is tended and you have someone trimming the box hedges to make them into fantastic animals and this kind of thing, that's sort of these top-down rules that are trying to be imposed on nature, and if you stop imposing them, then the hedges run wild and they no longer look like elephants. Whereas the emerging rules are more like a forest. A forest maintains itself. It has a certain order to it. You know, the trees are tall and the grasses are short, and, you know, there are structures to a forest you can find if you look at what the forest is doing. But that doesn't mean that somebody has to come along and tend the forest, because the forest maintains its own complex system.
How different do you find internet language, and we include text in this again, from generation to generation?
It's really fascinating, because there are these generational differences between different varieties of internet language. One that I find particularly interesting is the dot, dot, dot. So the dot, 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 or ellipsis, is often used by older people, and this goes back to the pre-internet era, in fact, to convey a break between utterances. So you're not really committing to whether you put a period or a comma. You can just put the dot, dot, dot as a way of splitting the difference. You might say something like, hi, dot, 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 how are you, dot, 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 do you want to talk sometime soon, dot, 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 and so on. And this is what this older generation is used to. You can find examples of this in postcards, even. For the younger group, they do the same thing with not committing to a comma versus a period in terms of breaks between utterances, but they use line breaks for this, or new messages. And so instead, the dot, dot, dot for this younger group takes on the connotation of, I'm leaving something unsaid, and I want you to infer what it is. And often that means, you know, maybe I'm actually mad at you, or maybe I'm being a bit passive-aggressive here, or maybe I don't actually want to do the thing that I've agreed to do. And this can create some cross-generational misunderstandings.
That's pretty amazing. So a lot gets read into those three dots.
Exactly. They have so much potential. It's such an exciting area.
It really is. There's another frequent example in the book, the progression of LOL from caps to lowercase. Did that alter the meaning of LOL, laugh out loud?
I think it's part of this overall progression of saying, okay, if, you know, LOL is an acronym, and originally acronyms are written in all caps because they're for technical terminology. If you're going to take National Aeronautics and Space Administration and abbreviate that to NASA, well, National and Aeronautics and so forth all had capitals at the beginning. So it makes sense to make that acronym into something that has capitals the whole way through. But if you're taking a social phrase like LOL or WTF or OMG, and you're making that into an acronym, those phrases weren't necessarily capitalized at the beginning in the first place. And so some people are capitalizing them because that's what you do with acronyms. And other people are saying, look, on the internet, all caps means shouting. And so if I'm not shouting, I want to use lowercase lol.
Okay, a possible correction here from one of our listeners. Rebecca in Lane County just emailed and said, I thought acronyms were different from initials.
So acronyms are used in various different ways. Some people use acronym to refer to the whole macro category of stuff that's referred to by its initials. Some people split up acronyms proper, which are things that are pronounced like NASA, where you create a new word out of it, from initialisms, where you have something like WTF and you pronounce each of those independently. But acronyms is generically used for the whole broad category as well. And if you want to get into specific subcategories, I don't notice trends in terms of how people use them differently, whether they're an acronym or an initialism, so I lump them together.
Okay, fair enough. I want to talk about, we're talking, by the way, with Gretchen McCulloch here on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Because Internet, Understanding the New Rules of Language. You're welcome to join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Tone of voice in messages comes up in the book. We were just talking about the dot, 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 but apparently for some people, periods seem passive-aggressive, particularly for younger users.
Yeah, so a period has this association with formal writing where it indicates sort of downstep in punctuation at the end of your sentences. So you might say, and now over to the weather. And your voice is really going down at the bottom of that sentence. And that period indicates that sort of falling intonation, which is fine if you're talking about something relatively serious. But if you're talking about something that's fun or that's positive or that's exciting, if you say something like, sounds good, period, now that downstep in intonation contradicts the positivity of your message. Sounds good. Does that sound good? Are you sure you're sincere about that?
Wow. So I was just reading into the three dots, how people take so much from that, but just the one dot apparently can get people a little hung up.
So you're, yeah, your three dots is kind of like, sounds good.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. I did the audiobook myself for Because Internet, and so I got to figure out, really, how am I going to pronounce all of this stuff? The punctuation chapter was such an interesting challenge for me.
Oh, I can just imagine. Yeah, and I just realized when I was writing ROFL for one of the teases for the show today that how am I going to say this on the air?
It's a big challenge, and switching between LOL and LOL for how I was pronouncing that, I ended up settling on, for the purposes of the audiobook at least, that I used LOL for the all caps version and LOL for the lowercase version. Even though that's not 100% how I would map it on in terms of actually saying it, it just seemed less ambiguous for the purposes of the audiobook.
This is where linguistics gets fascinating, though, pulling apart the fact that language is spoken one way and then written another way, and then what it refers to in our brains can be a whole different thing.
Yeah, even figuring out, so I had written in the book, like a very intelligent person, you know, writing supports longer sentences than speaking does. And then I get to reading my own darn book, and I'm like, wow, I really wrote some long sentences here and there, a pain to read out loud.
And to get the breath space in there.
Yeah, you know, what fool did this? Oh, wait, that was me.
Right. The emphasis that people get by repeating letters, like lots of H's at the end of, yeah. Now, that's not necessarily an internet thing, you're saying?
It's not necessarily an internet thing, but it is very common on the internet. And I did a study with another linguist, Jeff Lamontagne, about how people repeat letters and how we often actually repeat letters that are at the end of the word or at the end of a group of sort of letters, even if the result isn't actually pronounceable as written. So you gave the example of yeah with a lot of H's, but that H at the end of yeah is actually silent. You're not saying yeah. Right? Or something like same, where that E is silent. People write same E. So it's an interesting combination of, on the one hand, yeah, it seems like you're trying to represent how you're talking, but you're actually doing that by creating an unpronounceable version of this word, because it's easier to read if you repeat the letters at the end of the word rather than if you repeat something in the middle, where it kind of distorts the middle of the word and makes it harder to decipher.
Oh, so if you did same as same with a bunch of A's, it would not look the same. It wouldn't register,
exactly.
I think. Yeah.
So people do sometimes write same with a bunch of A's, but they're unlikely to write same with like a bunch of S's.
You point out, we were talking about the exclamation point earlier and how it's not used in formal writing. It's very important in internet writing. So talk about the sincerity exclamation point and if we're committing social faux pas when we leave them out.
The sincerity exclamation point is really interesting because, you know, the exclamation point starts as being used, you know, for excitement or anger or any of these strong emotions. But excitement, if you're excited about seeing someone, then you're also sincere about seeing someone. So if I say, you know, great to meet you, and I'm really excited about that, that also makes me sound more sincere. It's kind of like a Walmart greeter, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so adding in that exclamation mark in an email or in a, you know, somewhat formal context to say, you know, like, happy to chat, exclamation point, can add this note of excitement or sincerity or cheerfulness to something that could otherwise be a fairly, you know, mundane or routine email. And it provides a sort of social lubricant, like a polite social smile.
How big an effect do you find that the machines have on the language? I mean, when we have touch screens that make it easy to move our fingers around, but also things like predictive text.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that's really interesting about predictive text and autocorrect and spell check is that they can only predict words that they've seen before. They can only predict things that are already in their dictionary or their word list. And so just as the internet can make us more innovative in some ways by exposing us to more forms of language from people we haven't necessarily talked to before, it can also make us more conservative in other ways, because if you're, you know, it may be easier to follow the suggestions that your phone is trying to provide you with than to type something new or to type something in a more innovative sort of way. So it can, you know, there's this push-pull between innovation and conservatism, depending on the tools you're using to talk to people.
What do you make of the entire predictive answers, like what Gmail does now with suggesting you just write back, sounds great, push this button and it'll do that for you?
I find it really interesting. It really reveals how much of what we communicate is based on sort of polite social phrases, what linguists call phatic phrases, phatic. And these are things like, how are you? I'm good. You know, what's up? Not much. And those have a very similar function, and yet the correct response is different. The words they're made up of between how are you, how's it going, what's up, they're made up of different words, but they have this similar social function. And that's because their meaning isn't just constructed from the actual specific words they're in. It's based on this broader social context that we use them in. And a lot of phatic phrases are really stock phrases. So when you're saying something like, sounds good, talk to you soon, that's a specific, you know, phrase that you use in a particular social circumstance. And that's where these sort of tools really excel, is these stock phrases that we use all the time. If you're typing something more original, they're not going to be much help to you, and they don't really try.
We're talking again with Gretchen McCulloch, the Canadian linguist from Montreal. Her book is called Because Internet, Understanding the New Rules of Language. Now, this is cool. You get to a point in the book where you talk about gestures in informal writing. So basically, you think that emojis and GIFs are taking the place of us being able to make faces and gesture with our hands when we're talking?
Yeah, absolutely. It was so much fun to get to dive into the gesture research along with my podcast co-host, Lauren Gaughan, who's an actual gesture specialist. And think about how we use gesture and how that parallels how we use emoji. So if you think about sending someone, for example, good job with a thumbs up, you can say that out loud, a thumbs up gesture. You can send them a text that says good job with a thumbs up emoji. That reinforces your message. It's positive. But if you say good job with the middle finger, suddenly that has this very different meaning, right?
Right.
So the gestures can add this additional interpretation, this additional context to the words you're saying.
Very much so. Okay, you spent some time, by the way, Gretchen, on the poo emoji, which you point out very different with and without the smiley face.
Yeah, so it comes from the emoji, as you may know, originally started on Japanese cell phones and were eventually brought to the broader international market when Apple and Google were trying to expand more in Japan, and people wouldn't use their products unless they supported emoji. So they said to the Unicode Consortium, like, look, we need emoji on all devices. We need this kind of support. And Unicode, some of the most interesting quirks in the Unicode system of emoji come from the fact that they were adopting what the Japanese carriers had initially brought on. So if you're wondering why there's so much Japanese food in the food section of emoji, it's because that's what the carriers were trying to do for the local market. And this smiling pile of poo had this sort of subtle social meaning of like, oh, that's a bit crappy. or a bit of a different word that I'm not going to say on the radio.
Yes, thank you.
And that sort of social meaning of it's a bit of a softener, it's a bit negative, but it's not super negative, comes across partly because you have that face that makes it more positive than it would seem otherwise.
So the people who worry that emojis will replace text, are their concerns premature? Are emojis anything more than really just sort of a shaper of the message?
This is why I like the gesture analogy for emoji, because, you know, sometimes we do extended gesture sequences. You can play a game like charades. People play games with emoji where they try to send, you know, like create versions of movies and try to have their friends guess them. It's the same way you would with charades. But that's ultimately a playful use. It's not the general communicative use. And the general communicative use is also like that general communicative use of gesture, where they go alongside of words and they enhance words and they accompany words. But we don't really see this sort of rebus use of emoji, which is what a lot of people assume. You know, the idea of like you have a bumblebee which can substitute for to be or not to be. That's not really how we actually see emoji in authentic use when you look at the data.
So you get into the discussion, too, of chat versus other forms of online communication. Does the real-timeness of chat put some additional pressures, strictures, or change the forms of what people say to each other?
Yeah, I think the real-time nature of chat makes it really interesting because it's still an area of internet communication where you have the highest tolerance for errors and typos and self-corrections, you know, because you're trying to type so quickly so that your friend can see it on the other side, and you make a slip and then you correct it again in the next chat message and everyone knows what's going on. And that's kind of how, you know, if you make a slip of the tongue, you can just correct yourself in the next couple words and you barely even notice that this is happening. So it's very fluid and dynamic.
Well, I was going to ask about the fluidness of it all. I mean, do you find the conventions of each form of communication still very much in flux?
There is a lot of change. I know I definitely think that in, you know, another 10 or 20 years, because internet is going to turn into a history book. So, you know, now these days I was reading a book about internet language from 2001 while I was working on this, and at the time it was very current, and now you're reading it and thinking, okay, so this is an interesting snapshot of an era of history that is not quite like how we're talking now.
So this is a very exciting stuff for you, I would think, like watching the birth of a star in space.
It's really interesting. interesting, you know, in when we look back at Shakespeare or something, it's like, wow, there are all these new words being added at the time. But, like, people complain about it at the time. People in hundreds of years are going to think this era was fascinating. We could be fascinated by it now.
Okay, so one more thing I need to ask before we go, which is about memes. We haven't talked about those yet, and how big a bearing they have on language and how we're using it now.
Yeah, memes are really interesting. I enjoy the sort of stylized language of a lot of animal memes. And one of the things that I found really interesting is a quote from Limor Schiffman, who's a researcher on memes, which is, bad texts make good memes. So this artfully disarrayed language can make a meme seem more approachable, make it seem easier to participate in that kind of creativity, which I think is very empowering.
Bad texts make good memes. Okay, we'll leave it at that phrase. This is Gretchen McCulloch talking to us about her book, Because Internet, which, as she pointed out, will be a history book in 20 years. The subtitle of the book is Understanding the New Rules of Language. It's how we talk to each other in texts and emails and the ways that we communicate with each other online now. And thank you so much for joining us today, Gretchen. Very much appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. This was so much fun.